Okay, so I have an hour and a half, and I actually have two different talks to give. One is this talk, and if I'll get to another talk, great. If I don't, then we'll just stick with this one. It's a continuation of work. I want to tell you about three different papers. All three I actually co-authored with Yuval and a subset of other people who were involved in various projects, but Yuval was on all these projects, so you can think of it as a continuation of what Yuval was talking about this morning, but for some very specific application. So, and I want to show you today, at least in this talk, is a very simple trick, which is actually very simple to explain, and that proved to be very useful in a variety of applications. And I want to show you a connection between kind of different, between this dimension reduction and a communication complexity game, which on the face of it has nothing to do with the dimension reduction, and show you a bunch of applications, and then talk about clustering problems. So I'll start with problem formulation. I'll define it as a communication complexity game. I'll explain what really happened in this very simple game in terms of a dimension reduction. And so that might be of interest to some of you. And then I'll show you that actually this very simple trick, it's really, once you see the trick, you say, you know, it's so simple, you know, it's, I mean, but for some reason it took us some time to figure it out. I'll show you that this very simple trick actually allows you to solve two problems. One is approximate nearest neighbor, and another is K-clustering. And then in the second talk, I want to tell you a little bit more what people do in practice for K-clustering, and some observations that later we made with respect to this. Okay, so here's a problem statement. So we all know, in fact, Yuval told you this morning about Johnson-Lindenstrauss lemma. So endpoints in high-dimensional Hilbert space can be embedded into log n dimensional subspace with small distortion. And the question that I want to tell you about today is, well, what do we do in L1? What do we do in the Hamming cube? In fact, there is a result of Cherica and Sahai that says, well, it's actually impossible. So, but somehow using multiscale, you can do something here. The other problems that we are going to talk about today is approximate nearest neighbor search. There are many applications in computational geometry, in biology, in stringology, whatever you call it, information retrieval. And here's the different formulations. One formulation is given a database of names, a user with a target name wants to find if any of the database names are close to the current name without doing a linear scan, right? So here it's slightly misspelled, so the motivation is, well, you want to find out if this name or something very close to it appears in this list. If it's an exact match, it's very easy to do, right? It's very easy to do, but if it's slightly misspelled and you have to define the notion of distance, then how do you find it? Well, one way to find it is, there are ways to compare this name to every name in the list, and that's what I mean by linear scan. You just take your name and you go line by line and you compare if any of them are close to the name here. And questions that people ask in practice is, if you're given this list ahead of time, okay, you're not given the question, you're just given this list, is it possible to somehow pre-process it such that when given the question, you can quickly answer whether there is a name on this list which is close, and you have to define the notion of a distance to the name you typed in. And quickly means faster than just doing line by line analysis of this database of names. So that's one formulation. The geometric formulation of a nearest neighbor search is that given n blue points and a distance function, say Euclidean distance, stole this point somehow, and then you're given a red point, and you say, well, find me the closest nearest neighbor. By the way, before I get into this, let me just tell you that I noticed a difference between computational geometry crowd and the computer science crowd. One set of people say, you give me then blue points and I'll do something. And the other crowd says, I give you then blue points. And somehow these two crowds, you know, they make a difference who gives these blue points to whom. So anyway, so as I give you this blue point, so you give me this blue point, you somehow have to pre-process them in high dimensional space. And you don't know where the red point comes from. And then, given a red point, you want to quickly tell me which is the closest blue point. So one naive solution is store blue points as is, and then when given a red point, simply measure the distance to all the blue points. And again, that's a linear scan because it takes time to measure the distance to all the blue points in order to find something better. So the other solution is that actually in small dimensions, it's very easy to do. You pre-process these points in Voronoi diagrams, and you can quickly answer the question. And in high dimensions, that's a very famous problem of a curse of dimensionality that people don't know, and it's open until today. Given a very high dimensional Euclidean space, somebody gives us blue points, you have to build a data structure such that given any red point, you very quickly, meaning faster than the number of blue points, tell me which is the closest blue point to the red point. So red point is a question, blue points is your data set that you somehow pre-process. And what we showed with Yuval and Yael is that, and this is actually the stuff that I want to explain to you today, is how you can get so-called approximate solution. So I have to define what approximate means. So the way we define the notion of approximate is as follows. Given this blue set of points, imagine the experiment where someone gives us this red point. Given this red point, there exists the right answer. The right answer is the closest blue point to this red point, right? And you say that it's an approximate solution if you can make the following type of mistake. If the distance to the right answer is d, you're allowed to make a mistake which is 1 plus epsilon times d. So if this is a blue point and this is the right answer, right, that's the closest point, and epsilon is a parameter given to the problem, you're allowed to slightly error and give this blue point, because that distance compared to this distance is 1 plus epsilon times d. But if it's a red point which is right here, very close to this blue point, you're not allowed to make a mistake. You're only allowed to make a mistake which is 1 plus epsilon times the right answer mistake. Okay, so that's our notion of approximate solution. And I'll show you, actually, using very simple methods, that this problem you can solve for very high dimensional problem using elementary kind of tricks. So let's go back to the Hamming cube formulation. So the Hamming cube formulation is the following. Given a database of n blue points, which are just n bit strings, so here's n bit strings, you want to process them somehow. And then, again, given an n bit red string, which is again just a d bit 0, 1 vector, you want to find the closest blue string that matches to it. So here, the closest blue string is this one, right? So there's only one bit difference, I think. Yeah, so the last bit here is different, but otherwise, right, so if you flip one bit, it'll be exactly the red string. So one solution that I already told you about in the discrete space, which takes linear time in the databases, you just store all these points, you just write a table of these points, and then given any red question, you just compare this red question to every entry in this table, and you find the minimum distance, right? The distance here is Hamming distance, the number of bits you have to flip in order to go from this string to any of these strings. So the closest distance is this one, because you just have to flip one bit to go from here to here. So one naive solution is you just go line by line, you compute the Hamming distance, and you return the answer, which is the smallest Hamming distance. The other naive solution that you can think of is that you say, okay, there's d possible, if this is a vector of d bits, there are possible 2 to the d possible questions that you can ask. So you can just simply pre-compute for every possible d bit answer, you can pre-compute what is the closest nearest neighbor, because this is some collection of points, so the n of them, right? So now there are two parameters. One is n, which is the number of entries in this table, and the other is d, the dimensionality. And the dimensionality is big, so you know it's big, but I mean that's a valid answer. The valid answer is you say, okay, the d bits here that you can ask, so there are 2 to the d possible questions. So you can just pre-compute this exponential size table where for every possible 2 to the d question, you just already compute which is the closest nearest neighbor, and you just store this giant table. And then, of course, you can answer very quickly, because given this red point online, you just look up in this huge table and you compute the answer, and that's the answer you give. That's, if you can look up in one step, that's just a one-step solution. But the point is, of course, if this dimension is huge, say log n, where n is the number of points, the data structure is enormous. So here we have two kind of trade-offs. We either have to do work which is linear in the database, comparing this question to every entry in the database one by one, which is basically proportional to n, the number of entries, times d, the dimension, the number of bits. And the other extreme is you pre-compute this exponential size table of size 2 to the d, and then the answer time is just one step. You just look up the answer, which, you know, for every red possible question, you already know which is the closest nearest neighbor. But the data structure that you build is enormous. It's 2 to the d. And so the question is, well, can you do something in between? Can you build a polynomial in n and d data structure which, for any question, so if it's polynomial in n and d, you cannot possibly, and d is large, you cannot possibly build 2 to the d table. So is it possible to build a polynomial size data structure just looking at the blue points without knowing what the red question is, such that given any red question, you give approximate nearest neighbor quickly? Okay, so approximate is, again, you know, if the right answer is at the distance L, you're allowed to return an answer which is a distance 1 plus epsilon times L. Okay? And so what I want to tell you today in this discrete space is, how do you get this middle ground? How you, given epsilon, L, and D, you can build some sort of a clever data structure just looking at these points without knowing what the red point is, such that later for any red point you return the right answer quickly, and where your data structure is polynomial in n and d, even for large d. Okay. So that's the problem. I'll tell you how to solve today using elementary methods. And now let's talk about k-clustering. And if I'll have time, I'll tell you actually more about k-clustering than you care to know. So here's a problem. So given n points in say Euclidean space, d-dimensional Euclidean space, you want to find cluster centers. So here's the two cluster centers in the ambient space. And the cost of the solution is just the sum of distances from every point to the center. Okay, so I say find me two centers such that if you place these two centers anywhere in your space, the cost is just every blue point basically decides which is the closest red center to it, and the cost is just the sum of distances. And the question is, well, find the two centers that minimize that cost, right? So depending on where you place this thing, the cost will be different, and the points, these blue points are fixed, but depending on where you put the red points, the cost changes, and you want to find the smallest possible cost. Okay, so, and even in this formulation, it's actually an extremely hard problem. It's depending on the distance, one variant of it is going to be complete. So I'll show you, again, using this elementary methods, how to solve this problem using the tricks about the dimension reduction. Okay, so let me tell you the main technique. It's actually very simple. First is a communication complexity game, and second interpreted as a dimension reduction game. So here's a communication complexity game, and on the face of it, the game has nothing to do with the problems I described before, so just bear with me for a second, you'll see why this game is actually intimately related to the problems that we discussed. So here's a game. Given two players, Alice and Bob. Alice is secretly given some string X. Bob is secretly given some string Y, so they don't know. Alice doesn't know what Y is, and Bob doesn't know what X is. And they want to estimate the Hamming distance between X and Y with small communication, with small error, provided that they have common randomness. So Alice and Bob share, by whatever means, this huge common randomness, right? They first get together, flip a bunch of coins, and they have this joint, just bunch of coin flips, random coin flips. And now, given the secret X and Y, they want to quickly approximate, and X and Y are of the same length, let's say that they're just bit strings, they want to quickly approximate the Hamming distance between X and Y. And what they have to go with is just, so how can they do it? So the length, let's say that the length of X is equal to length of 1 is equal to n. Well, as a warm-up, how do they check that X is equal to Y? Well, that's easy, right? If they just want to check equality, you can pick any good hash function. Say, you know, pick a small prime, and you compute X mod the small, you know, pick random small prime, 17, and you compute X mod 17 and Y mod 17, and you check if they're the same, and you pick a bunch of small primes. And if every time, if X and Y are indeed equal, if you computed a bunch of small times, and every time comes out equal, then most likely X and Y are equal. And you can do analysis. You can pick all sorts of random hash functions, and if X and Y are equal, then you can do all sorts of tests. And if every time the small tests, the test is something where you compute some random function of X and Y, and it outputs a 0 or 1. So if every time it comes out that this test is equal, then you gain some assurance that X is equal to Y. But here we are trying to do something different. We are trying to estimate the Hamming distance between X and Y. Say we want to estimate if X and Y differs in 20 bits or 40 bits, right? Think of X and Y are huge, and you try to see, well, most of the positions are the same except for a bunch of, you know, small number of positions where the bits are different, but you don't know which bits are different. So the tricks of computing, you know, hash functions just fall on their nose, because if you compute, you know, if you pick a hash function and then compute hash function of X and Y, even if they differ in a single bit, most likely, if it's a good hash function, the answers will be completely different, right? So picking this trick of just checking equality that works very well, just completely bites the dust if you are trying to estimate the Hamming distance. So what can we do? Okay, so here's the main trick. So here's x, now let's break it up into bits. So this x is x1, so 2xn. So, and only others knows it, and here's y. Let's break it up into bits, y1 through yn. And how can they estimate the Hamming distance with small communication complexity? And again, let me remind you that we assume that Alice and Bob share this joint randomness. They have this joint coin flips free. Okay. So what we are going to do is the following thing. First, we're going to ask the following question. To estimate the Hamming distance between x and y within 1 plus epsilon and with small communication complexity, it's sufficient for Alice and Bob for any parameter L, think of L as a distance, to able to distinguish two cases. When the Hamming distance between x and y is less than L versus the Hamming distance between x and y is greater than 1 plus epsilon times L. And think of L as a parameter. So suppose we can do it, then basically what we can do is we can do this test. Yeah?
What does it mean mathematically they share randomness?
They basically have, think of it as a, say, polynomial size bit string, say a flans n to the c, where each one of them is equally likely. So think of every bit of this bit string as being just uniform 0, 1. So they have say if it's a k-bit vector, then every vector appears with probability 1 into to the k. So shared randomness is just uniform random bits, as many as they like. And as many as they like will be a function of the algorithm. But of course, if you want these things to be efficient, we don't want them to have too, you know, access to too many random bits. So we're going to measure how many random bits they want. So it will be, let's say, if this is a parameter n, let's say they have n to the c random bits, which means that they have, that they're given ahead of time just a bit string, which is joint, that they both have of length L, and every such bit string appears as probability 1 and 2 to the L. Okay, so they want to distinguish, so L here is a parameter. Let's say they want to distinguish if x and y is less than 20 bits apart or greater than 1 plus epsilon times 20 bits apart, and epsilon is a parameter. Okay, so why sampling doesn't work well? So one naive solution how they can try to estimate the Hamming distance is that if L is large, if let's say they try to estimate whether x and y differs in a quarter of a bits or half of the bits, well, that's easy to do. You just sample a bunch of positions of x. Let's check the third x and the fourth and, you know, the 17th. And Bob does the same, checks the fourth and the 17th, whatever it is. And for a few positions, they check if these positions agree. And if you're trying to distinguish large Hamming distances, is x and y differ in a quarter bits versus eighth bits, then with just a few probes into x that uniformly at random, you can get a very good estimate if x and y differ in an eighth of a bits or, you know, the quarter of a bit, whatever it is. But if we are trying to make a distinction for very, very small values of L, right? So L is huge, 10 million, and we are trying to distinguish if X and Y differ in 20 positions versus 40 positions, then sampling is just dead, right? Because you know, if you pick a bunch of positions at random, but the number of bits where they differ is very small, for sure you're going to miss the positions where they differ, so you will say that x and y actually are exactly equal, which is false because they actually differ in, you know, trying to distinguish 20 positions versus 40 positions, so you're going to croak. Well, maybe I should discuss it. That's how when I discuss things with you, well, we talk to each other that, you know, you're going to croak this and that, and then always reminded that this is not a way to describe the results after the fact, but I can't help myself, so it's not going to work, whatever. So we have to do something else. So here's the trick. Alice and Bob, so remember that they start with X and Y, so Alice is on the left, Bob is on the right, and here's this positions of Alice and Bob. So Alice and Bob pick the same n bit blue random string R, where each bit of R is equal to 1 independently and with probability 1 over 2L. Remember that this L is a parameter from here. We are trying to estimate if the Hamming distance between X and Y is less than L or greater than 1 plus epsilon times L. So you're given this parameter L, and Alice and Bob have this uniform randomness, and they modify it so that they have this new randomness where every bit, so it's exactly the same bit on the random string on the left and on the right, but one appears not with probability 1/2, but with probability 1 over 2L. If they have common randomness, they can modify it using standard tricks to have this joint probability distribution. Good. And now, given this X and Y, what they do is they just do inner product, so modulo 2. So what do I mean by inner product? You pick all positions in X where 1 appears in this blue string, right? So because 1 appears here, you pick this position of X. Because 1 appears here, you'll pick this position of X. And because 1 appears here, you'll pick this position of X. And you exclusify it together to produce a single bit 0 or 1. And Bob does the same thing. And then they just compare this single bit output. OK. So, and that's the entire trick. So, and the, just a probabilistic question that one should ask is the following question. Suppose we are just trying to estimate if the Hamming distance between X and Y is less than L or greater than 1 plus epsilon times L. What is the probability that these two bits will be the same according to this distribution? So this is the trick. You have to pick this blue distribution in this very careful way, which is 1 appears with probability 1 over 2L. And now you ask, what is the probability or difference in the probabilities if you are in this case versus you are in this case? Well, the actual analysis is pretty simple, but I'll tell you even a simple intuition. Basically, you pick positions here with probability 1 over 2L. And obviously, if you pick none of the positions where X and Y differ, these two bits will be the same. Right? If you pick none of the positions where X and Y differ, the two bits will be the same. On the other hand, if you pick odd number of positions where X and Y differ, then they'll be different. And if it's even, it'll cancel, it'll be the same again. But the point is, you have this set of L positions, and you're trying to hit it. And you can prove that for every value of L, there are going to be a constant gap in the probabilities in this case versus this case. Because the probability of hitting the set goes up exactly according in there's a constant gap in the probabilities. For this L, if you pick this blue string with probability, every bit with probability 1 over 2L, there's going to be a gap in the probabilities between this case and this case, simply because you'll have a higher chance to hit a slightly bigger set. Okay? And because of this, the two players can just exchange a single bit and have a constant probability gap estimating this Hamming distance and this Hamming distance. And that's the main trick. Now we are just going to pile up high and deep on this trick. So how do you pile up? Well, the first thing, well, there's a constant gap in probabilities. So how do we amplify this gap? You repeat a whole bunch of times, and you repeat a whole bunch of times using independent samples from this distribution, right? So you pick one blue sample, that gives you one bit. You pick another blue sample, that gives you another bit. And you do it, you know, log n times, and because there is a constant gap in the probabilities, you'll be able to notice it if you repeat this experiments independently at random, say, log n times. So how do we repeat as many independent r's but the same distribution? And that's the key. The key really is to observe that in order to distinguish between this case of Hamming distance L and Hamming distance 1 plus epsilon times L, you have to pick this very peculiar distribution, and then you amplify.
So don't you want, instead of XORing all of those positions, just multiply by random, just multiply mod 2 with the random as your
one? You sum it modulo 2, whatever it is, right? It's the same thing. You do, you say it's in the products and XOR, it depends which community you come from.
It's not with itself, not with itself, but with another random.
No. You use this blue, you just do inner product modulo 2. And the inner product modulo 2, just the intuition why it works, is the blue places just select places from the string which you exclusively vote together modulo 2, or you sum together modulo 2. I'm sure that there are other tricks that work once you see the thing. The main key is to pick this distribution correctly. And then you can do many different things. That's the simplest that you can think of. The point is, this is just a single bit output that they can compare, so it doesn't cost much. And because there is a constant gap in probabilities, you know, in one case it's, you know, point. You can calculate them exactly in one point, it's like 0.43, and the other, it depends on the parameters, it's slightly bigger, but there's a constant gap in the probabilities for any value of L. You just do it log n times, you amplify, you can distinguish. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Because here it basically the XO of everything, if they differ in one position, then they will be different, but if they differ in two, they might be the same again, but if you multiply it by random 0, 1, then they will differ with probability 1/2, regardless of how many positions are there.
No, look, we are trying to distinguish. Let's think of what we are trying to do. X and Y, we are trying to estimate if X and Y differ in, say, 20 bits. So the length of X and Y is huge, and we are trying to distinguish if they differ in 20 bits versus 40 bits, but we don't know where they differ. So you pick this blue vector where every bit you pick is probability 1 over 40, and then you just, and that just tells you which bits from X you sample, and you're saying that the set that you're going to hit, where this will result in a different bit, will be different in one case versus the other case. Okay. So, and to amplify, you repeat. And so here's a game how you can distinguish, a refined game with a small communication, how Alice and Bob can distinguish whether X and Y differ by less than L bits or greater than 1 plus epsilon L bits. You pick each R log n times. Well, actually, if it's this 1 over epsilon, you pick 1 over epsilon square log n bits, and that comes from the Chernoff bound. R's with the correct distribution, and the key here is the correct distribution, and you compare all these results. Picking this R with this distribution is actually, you can think of all these R's as just a matrix with the right distribution. So you're just really multiplying this string by a matrix with the right distribution. So you can think of it as just this peculiar random linear transformation that gives you very precisely whether you're in this case or that case. Compare this, so by comparing this linear transformation, and what I just actually told you is how to do dimension reduction, because you can think of every R producing a single bit answer. So this is a way to take two points, X and Y, in arbitrary dimensional cube and pick a bunch of randomness. And every bit of the answer for every random blue R produces one dimension in this 1 over epsilon square log n small dimensional cube, where the distances in this small dimensional cube tell you the distances in a high dimensional cube, but not all distances, but only distances between L and 1 plus epsilon times L. So whether it's less than L or greater than 1 plus epsilon L. And now you say, okay, so what do you do to capture all distances? You ask Emmanuel, you do multiscale, right? You do it for all possible scales. And that's, so we can get an embedding from large L to small cube that preserve ranges around L. And the key idea in applications, and you can build inverse lookup table for the small cube. So I have to explain what the hell that means. So what did I say? How many, let's go back. How many such independent samples did I pick? Well, you have to pick in order to get the probabilities right, 1 over epsilon square log n. But it's, if epsilon is a constant, it's log n. So if you think of this green cube, that's log n of log n dimensions. But 2 to the log n is n, which is polynomial. So in the small cube, you can actually brute force for every point in the blue. So the entire blue, green, I'm colorblind. The entire green cube has log n dimensions, so there's 2 to the log n possible points. So for every point here, you can already pre-compute the right answer ahead of time. And if it's multiscale, you do it for all scales. So you can build a bunch of these tables pre-computing all the answers in the green cube. And this is how you can pre-compute this fancy table. I mean, it's a probability distribution, but according to this probability distribution, you can pre-compute all the answers in the small cube. And then what happens when the red point comes in the original distribution? Well, red point also projects in a bunch of green cubes for every scale, because we are doing this multi-scale. And you have to do a little bit of careful footwork to find out which is the right answer, but that's easy to do. So that's the key idea, that because it's this, for this particular range of H, you can actually project it into a small dimensional space, so small that you can afford 2 to the dimension size solution, you can pre-compute all the answers. And that's the kind of a crank that if you turn, many times, we actually managed to get many papers just by turning this crank, or 2 papers, I don't really remember. And keeping very much under the wraps that this is a real crank we were turning. Okay, so let me tell you how to turn this crank. Applications of the dimension reduction to the in the Hamming cube for approximate nearest neighbor search and for k-clustering. I sort of already told you how to do it for the approximate nearest neighbor search. So remember what we started discussing initially. We had a bunch of blue points in high dimensional, say, not Euclidean space, but say the Hamming cube. You project it into a bunch of small cubes. You pre-compute inverse tables for every entry in a small cube. Why is this efficient? Well, because they're all polynomial size. How do we answer every query? Well, we project the question into the same multi-scale small projections, and we check which is the right one. How do we navigate between different L? You can check if the answer basically is wrong. Each projection is log n r's. User picks many such projections for each L range. There is log n of them. Now database builds inverse lookup tables for each projection in L, and each user can now project its query into a small cube and do binary search in L. So you can do binary search because you know when you missed it. Okay, so the main theorem is that we can build polysize approximate nearest neighbor data structure for high dimensional space. For the Hamming cube, that basically I told you all the details of the algorithm, but also for L1, for L2, and for the square of the Euclidean distance. There are some competing works, the slightly weaker guarantees, but very nice work of Induk and Matwani. And there are many subsequent works that were mentioned this morning by Yuval. I guess I want to tell you how you do it for Euclidean space. you basically do known tricks. Known tricks is to do the following. You pick a bunch of random lines, you project your points onto these lines, then you kind of see where most of the points hit, and you pick in this set where most of the points peak, you pick a random cut point, and everyone to the left has Hamming cube dimension 0, and everyone to the right has Hamming cube dimension 1. And you, if you do it sufficiently many times, you can sort of capture Euclidean space in a Hamming cube. It's not exactly true because if the it's not exactly true. So the actual way to deal with the Euclidean space also has to do with, again, multiscale, because there could be very dense clouds versus points out in outer space, so you have to deal with these distances. It's a bit messy, but once you have the Hamming cube, you can kind of use that machinery to handle also Euclidean space. I'm not sure this should, actually this slide I should have deleted because it's didn't make any sense, but I actually don't want to tell you what's really going on because it's messy. So let me tell you, I still have 45 minutes, and so unless you drag me off stage, I'll tell you about clustering. Huge number of applications in information retrieval, well, that's a boring slide. So let me tell you two independent issues. One is the representation of data, and the other is clustering. So representation. So, you know, and there was already a lot of presentations in this workshop about representation of data. So, for example, latent semantic indexing yields points in the Euclidean space with L2 distance. And mean-wise permutation of Broad et al. Yields points in the Hamming metric. So the point is, if you start with various applications, you know, web pages or graphics or whatnot, there are known methods to take these objects and convert it into points in a nice metric spaces like Euclidean space or Hamming cube, such that the notion of a distance tells you how these points are related to each other. So the points that are closer to each other are more closely related than the points that are far. And there is a big industry and very interesting results how you take some unstructured data, web pages, images, MRI, whatever it is, and convert it into a nice metric space. And there's actually some very interesting work in this area, including these two points. I wish I had time to actually tell you about it, but it's fascinating stuff. But that's the first step. That's kind of a pre-processing. So you take a data set, and you crank it so that it's in a nice, say, in a Euclidean space, such that the points that are closer, now every document, every web page just becomes a point, and the distance is how closely these web pages are related to each other, whatever else you're studying, I don't care. And now you can say, well, given these points, you want to somehow form them into clusters. So if there's a cloud of points kind of well isolated, you want to say, well, that's a well-formed cluster according to the distances. And so the question is, well, how do you form these clusters? Many other representations from information retrieval literature lead to other metrics, including edit distance that Yuval told you this morning, and various other metrics. Well, that's the plug that Yuval told you this morning. So here's a couple of examples of clustering. Min-sum clustering, form clusters such that the sum of intra-cluster distances is minimized. Seems like a reasonable definition. The other is K-clustering, pick K centers in the ambient space. So think of a Euclidean space. You're given a bunch of points, and you want to build big centers, but they don't have to coincide with the original points. They could be anywhere in a Euclidean space. And the cost is the sum of distances from each data point to the closest center. That's a problem that I told you initially as a motivating example. There's also agglomerative clustering. So here the idea is you pick some threshold distance and everyone that is, and you put an edge So given the same points, you put an edge. If it's below this threshold, you're forming a graph. And you don't put an edge if it's above this threshold. And then you take connected components of this graph. Of course, the problem with this is that there could be, if there's a lot of points that are close to each other, but they kind of go straight, there'll be these big chains. And then you begin to merge these clusters in some sort of a hierarchical way. So that's, there's a lot of work in this area called agglomerative clustering. And one question that you might ask is, well, which one is better? There are all these definitions. Which is a better definition? Unfortunately, there's no silver bullet. There's no answer. So consider the following two data sets. This is a blue data set, so that's one data set. And consider red data set, which is another data set. And we can ask, well, you form these clusters according to some of these methods, which is better? Well, for mean sum clustering, this is what mean sum will answer here. And this is what mean sum will answer here. And as you can see here, it sort of makes sense. You know, points that are together, it'll group together. And points that are apart, it'll keep aside. Here, for the intra-cluster distance, it will try to balance the two clusters. So even though kind of visually we will say, well, this is one cluster and this is another cluster, it will try to balance the two. So it'll grab two points from the other cluster to kind of balance things. So it seems to be getting things wrong. But for two clustering, it will actually do the right thing on the left and do the wrong thing on the right. So depending on your data, it's kind of incomparable. So let me tell you quickly how you can do this dimension reduction trick to solve optimally a k-clustering problem. So again, there's a whole bunch of parameters here. N is the number of blue points, d is the dimension, and k is the number of centers. And what I'll show you to do is how to cluster for two centers and find near optimum solution. So just to give you some of the history, when k is fixed, it is easy for small dimension. So Kleinberg, Papadimitri, and Raghavan shows that it's NP complete even for k equal 2, so for two centers. These people show that it's NP complete for RD for the square of the Euclidean distance. When k is not fixed, this is basically the famous facility location of k median. For fixed d but growing k, there was a couple of years ago this big breakthrough by Aurora et al. Using dynamic programming. But again, that's for fixed d, so the dimension is fixed. In this talk, I want to show you a PTAS for fixed k and arbitrary d. PTAS means polynomial time approximation scheme, which means if the optimum solution has some cost, I don't know, m, then we can find a solution which is within 1 plus epsilon times m, where m epsilon is a parameter, and parameter will go into the cost of our solution. Okay, so common tools that are used is dynamic programming, sampling, SVD, and previously in embedding, dimension reduction seemed useless because there are too many candidate centers and may introduce new centers. So what I'll show you, and again using just the crank that I explained in the beginning of the talk, is how you can use this method of dimension reduction to do a polynomial time approximation solution for fixed k, but arbitrary dimension for all this matrix. Okay, so main ideas. For two clustering, find a good partition is as good as solving a problem. So remember what the question is. The question is, given a bunch of blue points, we want to find the two centers such that the sum of distances of every blue point to the closest center is minimized. Well, and what we are willing to do is not to find the optimum solution, but something which is almost optimum, within 1 plus epsilon of the optimum. The point is, if we find the optimum solution, we find that these blue guys belong to this red center, and these blue guys belong to that red center, and we kind of found this optimally, then finding the center is trivial. You just pick a center of mass. So if you can find the partition, then finding centers is a no-brainer. Pick a center of mass, you're done. So that's good. So let's for now switch to the Hamming cube. So the question is as follows. Try partitions in the, well, no, this sentence makes no sense. Let me say, what I wanted to say is something like this. Suppose you can somehow find a bunch of partitions, many possible partitions, such that at least one of them is close to the optimum solution. Then basically you are done. Because if you have just a small polynomially many options, you can just evaluate the cost of each option, because evaluating the cost of the option is finding the center of, say you partition the data set into two centers, you're given a possible solution, so you find the center of mass for this partition, and you just evaluate the cost of this solution. So if you're given a bunch of solutions and you know that one of them is good, it's very easy to check which one is good. You just go through all the solutions and you check the right one. So that's what this bullet should have said. And the main point that I want to tell you is that embedding or dimension reduction is used to reduce the number of possible partitions. So here's how you do it. In fact, the property of the Hamming cube dimension reduction for this parameter L that we talked about before has a slightly stronger property. The property that one can prove is as follows. Take this parameter L and then see what happens to distances that are smaller than L and distances which are larger than L. Distances that are much smaller than L are going to expand, but not by much. In other words, if red is a L distance, which is roughly going to be preserved, the smaller distances will expand, but they'll never expand by a lot. A huge distances, these blue distances, will actually shrink, but they will not shrink all the way to L. So this projection actually has this additional property that it roughly preserves these distances around L. The distances that are much smaller expand by not too much, and the distances that are much bigger shrink, but not all the way to the L distances. And once you prove this property, you can actually use the algorithm. And again, the algorithm is just a picture. The algorithm works as follows. Well, you project all the points. Well, the first thing you do is you guess the distances between the two centers within 1 plus epsilon. And because you don't know what the optimum solution is, but because you are trying to approximate it within 1 plus epsilon, this is only logarithmic number of choices. So you can guess the distance between the two centers in the optimum solution. And once you guess the distance between the two centers, you can also guess in a projected space where these places will land. Because again, there's only polynomially many choices. And the main observation is that once you guess these points in a projected space, and you project all the distances at around this distance, the distance between the two centers, what I just told you, that I told you that the distances that are much smaller than this distance are going to expand, but by not by much. And the distances that are much bigger will shrink, but not by much. So things which are close to this blue center will remain close to this true center. Things that are very far, well, who cares? Because if they're very far, the distance between these two centers will be roughly the same, so just ignore them. And things in the middle, again, who cares? It's not going to change the solution by much. But things that are very close are actually going to stay within this center. So if you guessed correctly this distance, and you guessed correctly where it lands in a small cube, you actually can compute the entire partition. And because this gives you polynomially many choices, you can actually in polynomial time, efficient is an overstatement. In polynomial time, find the set of polynomially many partitions such that one of them is right. And that's the entire algorithm. Somehow when we write it, it takes, I don't know, like 10 pages to explain it. So guess two centers, map the small cube, partition in the small cube, measure the partition in the big cube, and this gets you within 1 plus epsilon. So I have half an hour. I want to switch to a different talk and tell you about yet another key clustering. The disclaimer, of course, it's never practical. This is just feasibility only. More ideas are needed for practical solution. In fact, more work has been done that Yuval has mentioned this morning. Dealing with 2K, I don't want to talk about it. So let me switch to a different talk and tell you more about K clustering. So this is a joint work with the same suspect and Leonard and Chetanya. So again, it's the same point, the same problem. The problem is you're given endpoints in d-dimensional space, and you want to partition it into k clusters such that you minimize the sum of distances to the cluster centers. But now we want to estimate, we want to check the what really happens in practice. So what really happens, so just graphically, let me show you what happens. You pick a bunch of centers, right? It's the same picture as before. You pick a bunch of centers. Every point in the every point becomes associated with the closest center, and you sum the distances to the closest center. It's exactly the same problem. So, and the question is, how do you find the centers? So the question is, well, actually I already told you this slide in its entirety from the previous talk. Once you partition the clusters, you just pick a center of mass, and the problem is hard even for k equal 2. And the problem actually, k-means problems dates back to 56. Approximation algorithms, algorithms with provable guarantees, PTAS basically means you want to have a good, polynomial running time depending on L, D, and K. I want to tell you what happens, and there is one approximation algorithms, and this actually improves the work that I explained to you in the previous presentation. Let me get to the Lloyd's heuristic, because that's what I want to tell you the remaining time. So what people do in practice is so-called Lloyd's method. Before we go through the slide, I'll just tell you in words what it says. You're given this clusters and you want to find two centers. What you do is you just pick, in the way people do it in practice, it is you pick centers at random, and then you pick k closest neighbors to the centers, and you move your potential center to the center of mass. And then you iterate. You again pick a k closest centers. You move your center to the center of mass, and you do it a whole bunch of times. This is so-called Lloyd method until somehow this thing stabilizes. So start with k initial seed centers. Iterate this Lloyd step. So assign each point to the nearest center, and then you move the center to the center of mass. So here's a point. So let's say your point set is this green points. So you start, let's say, with two centers at random, or just pick it in the space. And what you do is you first assign every green point to the closest blue point. So what happens here? Well, what happens here is that these three green points are closer to this blue center, and this point is closer to this blue center, right? And now what you do is you move every blue center to the center of mass. So what will happen? If you move it to the center of mass, this center has only one point, so it will just overlap with it. And this center will move to its center of mass, which is basically between these three points. So that's what happens, right? And now you iterate. You say, okay, now let's assign k nearest neighbors. So now these two points are closer to this blue center, and these two points are closer to this blue center, so you again pick it, and now the thing stabilizes. So again, if you pick it again, it doesn't move, so you say those are my two clusters. And that's what people really run in practice. They run it, I mean, that's what, this Lloyd step is really what people run in practice. The problem is there's no good analysis of it. So people don't know whether this stabilizes, in other words, if sometimes the things oscillate and they don't know when to stop, and they don't know how to pick the initial positions in order for this process to converge. So there's a bunch of work that try to analyze, and this is a really famous method. So what's known? Some bounds on the number of iterations. The latest work basically shows that if you pick the distribution right, which is exactly actually the distribution that we analyzed, that log n rounds gives you a good approximation. But the point is performance is very sensitive to the initial choice of points. And there's a mass literature in the practical community talking about good seeding method, where by seeding method, they really talk about how do you pick these points initially in order to start the Lloyd steps. So here's a very bad choice for seeding method. If you pick these blue points exactly like this, equidistant, it's not going to go anywhere. So even though we think of this as the right cluster and this as being the right cluster, this is a solution that will not go anywhere and will give you the wrong clusters, right? Because the distances are the same, so the centers have no place to go. But almost no analysis that proves performance guarantees about the quality of final solution for arbitrary k, k is the number of centers, and arbitrary dimension. So our goal in that work was to analyze Lloyd and try to prove rigorous performance guarantees for Lloyd-type methods. And we sort of do it for well-structured data. So let me tell you basically the result. There's if data has meaningful k-clustering, then there's simple and efficient seeding method such that Lloyd step returns a near optimal solution. Just a single step, Lloyd step returns a near optimal solution. So I have to tell you what meaningful k-clustering means. Well, this is propaganda. Let me just get to the actual meat. Meaningful k-clustering. So here's the notion of k-clustering. If near optimum cost can be achieved by two very distinct k-partitions, then the density of an optimum k-partition has little meaning and provides ambiguous classification. In other words, if there's a data set and there are two possible solutions and somehow their cost is roughly the same, what does it mean to cluster it well? It's kind of a not particularly meaningful. And furthermore, if somehow when you go from k clusters to k minus one clusters, the price doesn't drop, that means that again, it's somehow meaningless. So if the cost of best k clustering is roughly equal to the cost of best k minus one clustering, that's when you reduce one center, then k clustering yields only marginal benefit over the best k minus one clustering. And so that's also not particularly useful. So the question that we ask here is, what happens if it's a well-structured data, meaning there are big drops between k clustering and k minus one clustering, and the solution is unique? So example for bad clustering is, suppose you want to cluster with k centers. Well, if you put a cluster for k centers, well, where do you put the third center? It's not clear that the third center is going to buy you much. So here's our formulation of a good data set. Consider this delta square of x, cost of the best k clustering. And we say that x is epsilon separated for k means if the ratio between k clustering and k minus one clustering, that's the number of centers, is less than epsilon square. So it's a simple condition, drop in k-clustering cost already used by practitioners. And what we show basically is that if x is epsilon separated for k-means, then two low-cost k-clustering disagree on only a small fraction of data. So, in other words, if there's a unique or almost unique solution, if this condition is satisfied. Let me actually just get you to the sampling method and then stop here, because I think in every talk one should introduce just one idea, and I'm trying to introduce two, so that's a bad idea. The new sampling method that seems to work well is the following method. Typically, people say, given a data set, you just pick the centers at random. And what we suggest to do is the following procedure. Consider all distances between all the points. And consider the case where those are, let's say, two data sets that are that have good solution. What does it mean that they have good solution? Well, let's say there's a cloud of points here and another cloud of points here. And what you can do is you can say, okay, consider all n choose two distances between all these points. A good way to pick the centers would be to pick one random center here and another random center here, because then Lloydstep will find the center of mass quickly. So how do we find the two centers, the two starting positions, such that with high probability they'll belong to two different clouds as opposed to belonging to a simple cloud? And the idea is you consider all possible distances between all points, sum all these distances, and then pick two points whose distance you consider all possible distances. That's, you sum it all up. And then you pick two points proportional to its distance. Meaning, if the two points have very small distance, you'll pick it with a smaller probability than two points with a higher distance. So you pick two points by picking edges, and you pick edges proportional to its length, uniformly at random, right? So you sum up all the distances, and then you pick a point according to this. So pick two centers, C1, C2, by randomly picking pair x, y, with a probability proportional to the distance between x, y squared. And it turns out, and I don't want to get into details, but it turns out that picking this thing provides the right seeding procedure, and you can prove that if the data is well clustered, in one step, it gives you good answer. Yeah?
If you instead of looking for all the distances, if you just sample some of the distances, does it still work?
Well, the way you can do it is as follows. You first pick a center of mass of the entire data set, and then you pick the other point proportional to the distance to the center of mass, and then you iterate and you'll get the good solution.
So there's a linear time sampling process to emulate this.
Yeah, so this, and you can prove that even though it's n choose two edges, you can have another method to pick it which is extremely efficient.
Can you extend this to more than two?
Yes. So let me not go through the slides, but just tell you how to do it. You just do the same trick. Once you pick two centers, you have now every point. So let's say you pick these two centers. Okay? Now what you can do is you can measure the distance of all other points to this center. Okay, and let's say, suppose there is a third cloud of points that you haven't yet picked the center, so now you want to pick a third center. So again, you have all these distances, and some of these points will belong to this center, and some of these points, if the secret distance is going to belong to this center. Again, you pick the third center proportional to the distance from this point to the closest center. So again, you scale by the distance, and if you scale by the distance, you can show that this produces a good seeding method. There's more to it than what I have time to tell you, but I think that if I'll get into more details, I'll just, it'll be too much. So let me stop here and answer questions offline, rather than dragging you through this. It's going to be too much to go through the analysis. So let me stop here.